Earlier today, former Honolulu Police Chief Louis Kealoha and his wife Catherine Kealoha were arrested as part of a multi-year investigation by the U.S. Justice Department. The sprawling corruption investigation has so far resulted in the arrest of five other actives, our former Honolulu police officers, in addition to Kealoha and his wife, who is an attorney in the Honolulu City Prosecutor's Office. Here to review the facts of this complex case with us is HPR News Director Bill Dorman. And Bill, most of us know that this started with the theft of a mailbox, but how did something like the theft of a mailbox become a large federal investigation?
Aloha, Chris, and this is one of those stories that requires a lot of background,
right,
sort of to contextualize what's going on right now. And I should mention also that this morning, in addition to the arrests, as you said, Department of the Prosecuting Attorney for the city has placed Catherine Kealoha on leave without pay pending the outcome mm-hmm. of the case. As you say, this all goes back to a case of the Kealoha's mailbox and an uncle of Catherine Kealoha's, Gerard Puana. This is back in June 2013. The allegations of the case are that there was a plan to stage the theft of a mailbox in front of the Kealoha's home mm-hmm. and frame Puana for that theft. Mm-hmm. I'm oversimplifying a bit, but that is the crux of the matter. Now, at the time of this, Puana and the Kealoha's were in a dispute over family money, basically, mm-hmm. And that was itself the subject of a civil lawsuit. The allegations are that this was staged in an effort to discredit Puana as a witness. And from that flows so much else. So, again, you start with this, and then as you mentioned now, five current or former HPD officers under arrest this week, the 5th, just this morning. They all are tied to HPD's criminal intelligence unit. Mm-hmm. And again, the allegations, and again, clearly nothing has been, there have been no convictions,
right.
Still early in the legal process, but the allegations are that this was used, again, not to relate to Watergate or something, but there's the crime and there's the cover-up.
Right.
And that the cover-up, because of the nature of this is a 20-count federal indictment,
yeah.
And conspiracy and cover-up are a lot of the threads through this.
Mm-hmm. Is conspiracy difficult to prove?
You know, so much depends on the context of what you have and what they can build as a case.
Mm-hmm.
One of the situations that's I don't know, interesting may be the wrong word to use, but with this case, you have, because it was the theft of a mailbox, that is federal government property.
That's what made it federal.
That's what turned it from a situation involving the Honolulu Police Department to HPD having to turn this over to the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, which in turn turned it over to the Justice Department, mm-hmm. which brought in the FBI and again elevated this to a federal case.
And of course, had it been investigated internally by HPD, it could have been a very different story. But it was as soon as you mess with a mailbox, it becomes federal.
And that's what you have now, is a 2-year process. The federal grand jury just ended a 2-year investigation yesterday. So today you have the arrests. And again, from here you have the case building. You'll have the appearances this afternoon. But boy, this is, the twists and turns will continue from here on in.
And we still don't know what kind of evidence the feds have. Is that right?
That is true.
Yeah.
And we're going to be learning a lot more about this case on both sides as well. I'm sure on the defense side, we're going to be seeing a lot of things come out. So stay tuned,
as I say. The story hasn't gone away, so thanks very much. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. And on Wednesday, a federal judge in Hawaii blocked the Trump administration's latest travel ban a day before it was set to take effect. Federal District Judge Derek Watson wrote that the president's latest executive order, quote, suffers from precisely the same maladies as its predecessor, because it doesn't show that allowing travelers from the countries in question would be, in its language, detrimental to the interests of the United States. This is the third time the state of Hawaii has challenged a version of the Trump travel ban. It's the third time a court has agreed with the state. Hawaii Attorney General Doug Chin called the decision another victory for the rule of law, adding, "We stand ready to defend it." And he spoke with Bill Dorman yesterday, who began while asking him where and when he expects to make that defense.
Well, I think our concern has always been that we just didn't want the president to be issuing executive orders that violate the Constitution or violate our immigration laws. And that's really what's been happening with these with the travel ban from the very beginning. So here we are in the third round, and essentially what you have is really the same anti-Muslim bias. It adds North Korea and Venezuela, but in our lawsuit, we didn't even challenge North Korea and Venezuela. As it turns out, there's only less than 100 people that come from North Korea anyway into the United States each year, in comparison to the more than 150 million people that were banned by under the travel ban from the Muslim majority countries. And then even Venezuela just seemed like window dressing, because it was only banning certain government officials. So actually, if you take away North Korea and Venezuela, you're left with the exact same ban that existed under Travel Ban 2.0. We challenged it again, and we're very pleased with the Hawaii federal judge's decision.
And on Travel Ban 2.0, as you say, the Supreme Court had been scheduled to review that when the president issued the third executive order. So do you expect this to wind up with the Supreme Court? And if so, what's your strategy?
Well, I'll tell you one difference that exists with the third travel ban, and that is that this one is permanent in the sense that it's indefinite. The previous two travel bans were issued because they were supposed to be for 90 days or 120 days. So essentially what happened is that when the president issued the third travel ban, the U.S. government then went to the U.S. Supreme Court and said, look, this is all moot. You don't have to decide any of this. And, you know, the sense we get is that the U.S. Supreme Court was, rather eager to not have to decide this. And so what they did was they have been issuing decisions that have rendered it moot. Now we're going to have the third one. Because this one's indefinite, I think this one is more likely to get appealed all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, where they are going to have to make a decision.
Something like a timeline is probably impossible to project, but I'll ask anyway.
Right. You know, everything's on this with this litigation has just happened on an expedited briefing, emergency motion type schedule. I was actually just at the State Bar Association yesterday with the appellate section, and one of the comments that was made about this case is how it's like every exception to the normal legal procedural rules is being invoked in order to move this case through the system. And I don't actually mean that's coming from us. I think the U.S. government has been very earnest and very, very pushy about wanting to get this case resolved. And largely, I think because, if I were to be fair to them, I think their argument would be that this is a of national security concern. It impacts the president's authority. So they want direction on it.
Hawaii clearly has rich history of immigration, broad culture of acceptance and tolerance, but there are some critics who have said, why is Hawaii taking such a leading role in this, and is
right.
that the best use of resources? What's your response to that?
Sure. I mean, I really think of it as an attack on one protected group of people is an attack on every protected group of people. So essentially, first of all, there is a Muslim population in the state of Hawaii. I've met them. They're very special, wonderful people. It's probably been one of the blessings of being part of this litigation has been to get to know the people who live here, who are doctors, who are lawyers, who go to our schools, and just to see them. But I think even more than that, many people who are minorities, of which I myself am included, I'm Chinese American. We all know that this is not a good sign if the U.S. government is targeting or scapegoating one group of people. And that's what it feels like. I mean, you know, in my own judgment, that's what it seems to be. So, you know, to make sure that the U.S. government doesn't, you know, take further license to do something that impacts Hawaii even more severely, you know, this seems like the right thing to do.
And as you know, the Trump administration's argument is that this is a matter of public safety. These folks have not been vetted in terms of coming into the United States. Without getting into the entire right. argument of the case, what's your elevator speech in terms
right.
of response
right.
to that?
You know, it's always been this, is that, you know, the president does have a duty to regulate our national security, but just don't do so in a way that immediately bans, you know, more than 150 million people from coming into the United States. And that's essentially what this executive order is saying. It's saying that if this is your nation of origin, you know, Yemen, then it doesn't matter if you left Yemen when you were 3 months old and then moved to Belgium or moved to Australia. You, in the eyes of the U.S. government, are now presumptively a terrorist, and you have to overcome that presumption by trying to convince the U.S. government otherwise to get into the country. That sounds too much like the Chinese Exclusion Acts and the Japanese Exclusion Acts that existed before in the 1960s and 50s. That is actually a time that Congress specifically said they didn't want to repeat when they passed the Immigration and Nationality Act. So, you know, so here we are. It's a generation later, and once again, this idea is being floated out there, it's not a good one.
Do you think that context is something that is understood broadly across the nation, as opposed to a lot of headlines come up, a Hawaii challenging ban, Maryland challenging ban, but that context that you put it in, do you think that that's something that is broadly understood in the country?
You know, I don't think it resonates with a certain group of people. I know for many people, you know, there's many people I can acknowledge who live in fear. And to them, having something like this get passed is just an indication that the government is doing something and it helps them sleep better at night. This does not make me sleep better at night at all. And the reason why is because just trying to appease people's fears by passing some sort of scapegoating, you know, dog whistle sort of, you know, executive order that just really, you know, hurts an entire group of people. That is, you know, that's not the right way for government to be running. And it's something that eventually causes, you know, people to be looked down upon and you know, rendered into a sort of second-rate citizenship. So I feel very strongly that we should be fighting against that. So the other answer I'd give to that question is that I think there are a lot of people who do get it. You know, I think there are so many people who really do track this and are able to say, you know, I see exactly where this is going, and this is not a good direction. So that is the reason why we need to fight it.
And you mentioned in terms of your own experience as a Chinese American growing up suburban Seattle, I understand,
yep.
And your high school was mostly white kids.
Yes. Yeah.
How is that influenced or shaped your views as you look at this, apart from the legal
right.
structure itself?
Wow. Well, I would say, you know, I've lived in Hawaii since 1989, and I think that's actually the greatest blessing that is what Hawaii has taught me in the 27 or so, 28 years that I've lived here, which is just how much Hawaii just respects and celebrates diversity and inclusivity. I mean, I can't tell you how, you know, I think that's something that's really special about the state. And I think even when the governor and I were talking about this lawsuit and about Hawaii being in a unique position to challenge it, that was one of the things we talked about. I told him, you know, I actually think Hawaii has a very unique story to tell. You know, we're so diverse and we're so, you know, to my mind, successful in that regard, that I think we have a great chance to be able to talk about this and talk about this in front of the U.S. Supreme Court.
You've been state attorney general about 2.5 years now. You're former managing director of city and county of Honolulu. How about your own political ambitions?
You know, I'm not comfortable talking about that yet, and largely because I've been trying to focus on this, you know, this litigation and really just trying to get it through. You know, I realize that there's a lot of, you know, political buzzing that's going on, but I think the most important thing for me right now is just to make sure I'm focused on my job.
Fair enough. Thanks for making time for coming by and talking to us today.
Thank you.
Doug Chin is the Attorney General of the State of Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, a study that might puncture some illusions about ethnic equality in Hawaii. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're remembering the life of an American blues musician who has found a home and new musical directions in Hawaii. He was born Henry St. Clair Fredericks in New York City in 1941, performs under a stage name, and that's the name we're looking for today. He grew up in Massachusetts and still remembers the first time he heard Hawaiian music on his father's shortwave radio, saying it was the sweetest sound he had ever heard. He's had a successful 50-year performing career that has seen him merge his country blues style with musical forms from around the world. In his current incarnation, he's playing his songs on his national steel guitar with his hula blues band, while local steel guitar virtuoso Bobby Ingano accompanies him. It's the sound that inspired him so long ago. This morning, we're looking for that stage name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Inter Island Solar Supply, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
The state of Hawaii is happy to present itself as a haven of ethnic diversity and equality of opportunity as represented by its public schools, but a new study of ethnic inequality in public education by a professor in the Ethnic Studies Department at UH Manoa concludes that while the diversity is there, the equality is not. The two ethnic groups that are most widely represented in the public schools are the least present at UH Manoa. Jonathan Okamura is the author of the study, and he joins us in our studio. Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
What were the kind of things that you measured in order to draw your conclusions?
Well, my arguments are based on underrepresentation of minorities, particularly Filipino Americans and Native Hawaiians, the two largest groups in our public school system. Mm-hmm. And at Manoa particularly, they're very much underrepresented. So, Native Hawaiians, for example, 26% of public school students, but only 14% at Manoa. The two groups are better represented at the community colleges, at Hilo and West Oahu, but not at Manoa, and they've never been, I would argue, proportionally represented at that campus.
Well, what can be done?
Well, as I say in my report, the issue is one of underfunding of both the public school system, K-12, and the UH system. So at the UH system, particularly Manoa, the response to the underfunding from the state legislature is to raise tuition. And over the years, tuition has been raised to about $11,000 per year now at Manoa for resident undergraduate students. And it's had this impact of declining enrollment in the past 6 years, including this fall semester, even though the administration did not increase tuition at all this semester from the previous year. The first time in 17 years something like this has happened. And the reason for it, they finally realized that tuition had reached a point where the parents of kids from Hawaii cannot afford to send their own child to the university.
$11,000 a year takes a serious bite out of most any middle-class income.
Certainly with the high cost of living we have here in Hawaii, and particularly for housing. And it has been the response of the university, as I said, to raise tuition. So the previous tuition cycle from 2006 to 2012 raised tuition $816 each year. And subsequently, from 2012, we've had 6 consecutive years of enrollment declines at Manoa, particularly of resident undergraduates.
It's difficult to compare Hawaii to any other state because we have an entirely different and probably much more varied ethnic mix than any other, yeah?
Well, one of the issues when it comes to the K-12 system is that we have the only statewide school district in the nation.
That's what's different, yeah.
Yeah, but because of that, that should provide for greater equality, because in California, where property taxes provide the bulk of school funding and the state is divided into numerous school districts, that's almost a guarantee of educational inequality. A student living in Beverly Hills obviously is going to get a better public education than if you're going to school in South Central L.A.
Sure, sure. Well, with the system set up in ways that are, and I'm sure specifically designed to avoid inequality, what do you attribute this?
Underfunding from the legislature. Consistently underfunding our public school systems. And there have been studies to establish that the underfunding is at a level such that the public schools do not provide even an adequate education to our students.
After a while, doesn't that become part of a whole educational culture?
I think it has become a practice, certainly at the legislature, to underfund the public schools. They don't respond in ways that would address the persistent problems, such as the teacher shortage. This can be attributed to the low salaries, comparatively, of our public school teachers, which results in a high turnover rate of teachers leaving the public schools for alternative kinds of employment. So each year in August when the public schools open, there's always a shortage, several hundred teachers who are needed in the public schools. That figure is even after emergency hire teachers have been employed. Those who lack any degree in education have just a bachelor's degree. Nonetheless, they're put into a classroom and they have 3 years to earn a teaching certificate, but with no training necessarily in the area in which they're teaching.
When you've raised tuition for higher education and underfunded public education, secondary school education, by the effect is to create an underclass.
Well,
in a sense, right?
Well, not so much. I don't focus so much on class terms. I see this as an issue of ethnic inequality that particular groups.
Well, an underclass tied to ethnicity.
Oh, definitely, yeah. There's certainly a very close relation between class and ethnicity in Hawaii, as there was historically between class and race. But that has certainly emerged as an issue in Hawaii in terms of this underclass, people who are underemployed, for example, or whose options are limited to service work or sales work. in Hawaii, given the nature of economy, our dependence on tourism.
In the plantation days, it was very much in the interests of society as a whole to maintain a class of, you know, service workers who didn't have to be educated mm-hmm. past a certain point. I'm sure. wondering if that created a kind of pervasive culture in public education.
Well, and I wouldn't necessarily say that, because after the war, through the Union, the ILWU in particular, the rise to power of the Democratic Party, they instilled more values regarding racial equality.
Yeah.
Although over the decades, that emphasis has declined. I don't see the Democratic Party as being the same party in the 50s and the 60s that was much greater concerned with racial equality, with economic reform, with social justice. The party, as most voters in Hawaii, have become much more centrist in orientation.
Have we become somewhat complacent?
I think so. We allow our legislators to continue to underfund the public schools, despite the $1 billion surplus last legislative session and the $1 billion surplus at the end of the most recent fiscal year. There's no excuse at this point for underfunding the public schools. The money is there. I can't consistently blame them, though they did give increased salaries to the public school teachers.
Well, the trouble with any mention of a surplus is there are an awful lot of – it's get in line for that money, because there are an awful lot of other needs awaiting, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, if we had a state legislature here, a member of the education committees, either in the Senate or the House, they would be saying to me, public education isn't the only problem. You should see all the people come to us. We've got the homelessness problem.
Yeah, exactly.
And they would raise these issues. But my response would be public education has to be made a priority. There's a huge constituency of the parents of the 181,000 public school students that they should be paying closer attention to.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us about your study. We're going to be hearing more about it, I'm sure. Thank you.
Oh, thanks very much.
Jonathan Okumura is a professor in the Ethnic Studies Department at UH Manoa and the author of Unequal Opportunity, Ethnic Inequality in Public Education in Hawaii, which was recently published by the Hawaii State Teachers Association. The study will be posted on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Tom Crabtree from Aspen Medical. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The Great Mahele of 1848 changed Hawaii forever, making private ownership of land possible for the first time. Issues surrounding land and its ownership have haunted the islands ever since, and the prevailing opinion in the native Hawaiian community has been that Hawaiians were dispossessed by the Great Mahele. But geographer Donovan Preza has a different perspective, one he has shared with HPR reporter Ku'uwe Hiraishi, who's with us in our studio. Hi, Ku'uwe.
Aloha, Chris. Thanks for having me.
This really does go against conventional thinking, conventional wisdom, doesn't it?
He goes against the grain with this research, and we were talking about this earlier, but there's this Hawaiian saying, pa'akavaha, nana kamakahana kalima, shut your mouth, observe with your eyes, and work with the hands. And I think that's sort of been the case in academia for a while in terms of, you know, not questioning some of the stuff that narratives that came out of our understanding of history.
What led Donovan Preza to take his different perspective?
It was the data. It was the research. You know, it's questioning what he was looking at, and his master's thesis focused on sort of reexamining Hawaiian dispossession mm-hmm. during the time of the Great Mahele. So, I don't think he set out to prove anybody wrong. I think he just looked at the research and figured that one out.
Here's what he said to you, Ku'uwe.
My argument is we have something. we just don't realize we have it because the story and the narrative has been it's not ours. The Mahele was a foreign imposition. And if you believe that fundamental assumption, if you believe the Mahele was not yours, the Mahele was not a Hawaiian thing, then you don't know what's yours. You don't know that your ancestors preserved for you something.
Gouvet, was it a foreign imposition?
So he argues that it was not. You know, he's looking at Kauikeaouli, King Kamehameha III, saying he knew what he was doing. Mm-hmm. He did have foreign advisors, but he wanted to essentially preserve or codify an opportunity for Native Hawaiians to keep their land. And we covered a case earlier this summer where this actually played out in real life. So a 15-year court battle on Maui with Ke'eo Moku Kapu of Lahaina, who was able to trace his ancestry back to an original land commission awardee, who was his great-great-granduncle. And in that process, was able to reclaim land that had been taken by the pioneer mill, the sugar company, in Lahaina for so long, for over 100 years. He was able to reclaim that land once he went and traced his ancestry to it. So that's one example of how the Great Mahele and land laws changing at the time were taken advantage of by a lot of Hawaiians.
Well, you know, it always seems to me, Kuve, in studying history, that it's useful to take a revisionist point of view at one point or another, no matter what that point of view is, just because you don't want conclusions to sort of atrophy and be, you know, set in stone for future generations to not have to think about.
It will be exciting to see the kinds of conversations that come out of research like Preza's, just because I think it's healthy for us to start talking about things that we might not have questioned for a while. He does come up with facts in this case. You know, he's not just changing the narrative. He's got evidence. And one of the things I wanted to mention was that Hawaiians were able to get land through other mechanisms during this era. So the fee simple sale of government land is one thing that he really pushed, or that he really found a lot of evidence for, and that was lots of like 50 acres or less that was being sold for a minimum of 50 cents an acre.
Now, you're talking post Great Mahele?
This was during the Great, yeah. So right after the Great Mahele, they were able to claim land of 1 to 50 acres or 50 acres for 50 cents an acre. And there were a number of Hawaiians that took advantage of that opportunity. And this was made available for Native Hawaiians who did not have sufficient lands through other means. So there's other facts in there that we haven't really cared to look at, I think, because we were sort of clouded by, you know, the narrative of this being a foreign imposition.
Well, of course, a lot of Europeans were quite ready to take advantage of it as well.
Right.
And perhaps the preponderance of them created the you know, impression that lingers to this day.
Exactly. And he's not, I just want to make clear that Preza did not say that Native land dispossession did not occur at all in history.
Yeah.
He's saying the Great Mahele wasn't, there's more to the Great Mahele than just dispossessing Native Hawaiians of lands, of land. A lot of dispossession happened after that.
Well, you're running a story on this next week.
And I am. It'll be exciting.
We'll look forward to it. Thanks a lot, Kuve.
Mahalo, Chris.
Kuve Hiraishi is the General Assignment Reporter for Hawaii Public Radio, and you can find her story on the Great Mahele at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Ira Plato. On the next Science Friday, the latest on gravitational waves and why that collision of two neutron stars is so important to understanding our universe. Plus, Walter Isaacson's new book about how Leonardo da Vinci engineered Mona Lisa's iconic smile and how da Vinci so wonderfully bridged science and art. It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
We encourage listeners to call in with their thoughts at our talkback line, 808-792-8217. And earlier in the week, we looked at the closure of several Honolulu parks due to damage caused by a homeless encampment and whether or not a safe zone for the homeless could have prevented that. A number of listeners called us with their thoughts.
Sandy Friedman calling from Nu'uanu. Singapore is an island half the size of Oahu with six times the population, and yet they have no homeless. They build an average of 25,000 low-income flats per year. They have built over 1 million low-income flats in the last 25 years. They get the money from their employee retirement fund. Why can't we do the same here in Hawaii?
Hi, this is Marcia from Honolulu, and I am calling regarding the homeless situation. And I remember that after the Second World War, there was a large number of homeless people who were, and the veterans who were coming back. And what they did was they set up Quonset huts in the public parks. And I remember that Frank Fosse did a set of Quonset huts in Ala Park, or basically in the safe zones if you wanted to set up Quonset huts for to provide general services with bus transportation in and out of the city. That might help also. But whatever happened to Quonset huts? Thank you.
Hi, my name is Misha. I'm from Maui. I have a story about a friend of mine who is homeless. He is in his 60s. He was in a shelter, and he didn't get well. And he soiled the bed, and because of that, they got the ambulance. He had the patient send him to the hospital. And after 3 days, he went back to the shelter. All his stuff was given away. They said, oh, we threw it out. And he says, well, can I stay here again? I'm all well again. I'm not, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. They gave me new medicine. No. Cannot. So there he was with nothing anymore. Lucky enough, he had his cards. And then he bought a pack of cigarettes and wanted to figure out what to do. Some guy from a homeless guy came by. Give him a black eye because he wanted his cigarettes. But the point is, that is the homeless shelter is not really the nicest place.
We also had some calls about other topics that we've covered.
Aloha. My name is Heidi Lavora. I also endure helicopters off of Kaneohe Bay. They come in and land on private property in an R10 zoned area, and it just shatters the peace, and they come in over whoever's in the ocean way closer than I think it's a requisite 300 feet that they need to stay above residential areas, and the FAA does not care to do anything about it.
Paul from Maui, and my comment is concerning the domestic violence issue. The first time is the last time. It's never okay, and you never hurt the one you love. Thank you.
All this week, women around the world have been speaking out against sexual assault with the hashtag MeToo campaign. A woman named Mona emailed us from Kula with her personal story. Quote, when I was 12, I stood on a street corner waiting for the bus in the middle of a scorching August day in Palm Springs, California. It was hot, and the bus wasn't coming fast enough. A man pulled up and asked me if I needed a ride. I accepted, thinking I didn't want to spend all day waiting under a blazing sun. The man had other ideas, taking me far into the desert before trying to rape me. I escaped, barely, by fighting back, and then jumping out of the car into a large date grove where I hid for hours. I never told anyone about it, just sucked it up as the consequences of a bad decision. My fault, of course. It haunted me. Yet shame kept me from sharing the experience with friends or family. Years later, I woke up and began writing about it in a fractured spoken word poem that provided the catharsis I sought. We thank everyone for that feedback and email us at talkback@Hawaii Public Radio to weigh in with your ideas and thoughts. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line at 792-8217.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Locations, Noheia Gallery, and Straub Medical Center.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we told you about a Grammy-winning musician who has made Kauai his home. He moved there in 1981 and formed his first hula blues band with local musician friends. His modern incarnation, which features steel guitarist Bobby Ngano, is still performing today and just played as the opening act of the Hawaii International Film Festival a couple of years ago. His real name is Henry St. Clair Fredericks. He's a graduate of the University of Massachusetts, where he studied animal husbandry and veterinary science before deciding to pursue a music career. He became a star in the 60s with his acoustic and electric blues stylings, eventually expanding his musical palette to include styles from around the world. He attributes his lifelong love of Hawaiian music to the songs he heard as a child on his father's shortwave radio. You know him by his stage name, Taj Mahal. And Dom, our Backyard Quiz winner for today, knew that too. That's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Pianist Rich Crandall, like all accomplished jazz artists, has built a very personal means of expression on his instrument, one that is informed by the work of any number of musicians who've gone before. Tomorrow night he'll be performing in our Atherton studio, celebrating compositions by his favorite pianists. We spoke a couple of days ago about his plans for the concert.
Well, I'm a piano player, and I was always attracted to these different players. They inspired me in different ways. Mostly, they can show so many different aspects of personality through the same instrument, all playing the same notes, but all expressing different degrees of tenderness, intimacy. I guess I like the intimate players a bit better, too.
What are the ways you can evoke that on a piano?
Tight harmonies. Mm-hmm. Of course, tachatura, the touch on the piano.
Because when you talk about intimacy as a quality evoked by a jazz piano, I think, for example, of Bill Evans.
Yeah. So.
That's his best-known composition, Waltz for Debbie.
Yeah.
And in that, as you say, tight harmonies, your hands are actually physically pretty close to each other at the center of the keyboard with some notes that at times momentarily clash, right?
Right. Well, they clash in the eyes of the beholder.
Yes.
That's a dissonance.
There you go.
It's an A minor ninth against the melody, so you have... And you can always, you know, when you're using something like dissonance, resolving the dissonance is part of resolutions and dynamics.
Yeah.
Are such an important part of playing the piano, whoever the composer is and whoever the player is. Those are elements which I like. So,
to me, the wonderful thing about the instrument, the thing I'm always envious of, is the ability at a moment's notice to completely change the nature of a harmony because you've got everything laid out right in front of you. And you can do that on the fly.
It comes off most interesting on the fly, especially to the person who's playing.
Sure.
When you uncover something that you didn't expect yourself. But that's the nature of improvisation. It's not following the plan, but it's sort of passing through the structure of a song and letting the song sort of play itself.
And maybe even surprise yourself playing.
Sure.
The nature of improvisation itself is something that the lay listener doesn't necessarily understand. But you're given a song. That song has a structure, a chordal harmonic structure. And within that, you have some pretty clear options of what to do. And you work with those, right?
Right. Every song, if you consider it as having time or meter, structured time, and usually there's a prearranged harmonic structure, mm-hmm. Which lays over that. That actually is what the song is. The melody that's written tends to be, denotated, and often a jazz player will play a chorus as the song was originally with the original melody,
yeah.
and then use the same chord structure, but then play music that evolves either out of that melody or out of the moment, out of the imagination of the performer. But it all fits. When I play for children, I always say, we can play this song, and then when we start playing our solos, if you want, you can actually keep on singing the song, and they should all fit. So the structure remains inviolate,
That's a good way to describe it.
I can just take a quick Stevie Wonder song that most people know.
Sure.
You Are the Sunshine of My Life. And now I can start to improvise, but the structure is essentially the same. I might substitute an Eddie Russ chord for the first chord.
Made a few discoveries just in the act of doing that, didn't you?
I wasn't expecting to play this song today.
Well, you see,
off the top of my head. Being around you, guys, you're around creative people, and they bring out different parts of.
Well, Rich, that
and you don't even have your guitar in your hand.
No, that's right. Well, I'm sparing you. The whole idea of keeping the melody in mind as you're listening to the improvisation. I went through that exercise as you played those variations on the Stevie mm-hmm. Wonder song, and it was clear. I think that's a good way for the listener, maybe the lay listener, to guide his or herself through jazz improvisation.
And I've always enjoyed performers who use the melody in the spirit of the classical theme and variations, and don't jump in already deconstructing the melody completely.
Yeah.
This is my taste, but I'd like to have the new melodies, the improvised melodies, emerge out of the original conception and then take it out as far as you might want to go.
And then
come back.
If you start in at the out of left field, you've left the listener behind frequently.
Yeah, yeah.
After a while, the personality of an artist like a Bill Evans or an Oscar Peterson or some of the other mm-hmm. pianists we've talked about and whose work you're going to be playing in your concert becomes very clear. You can hear a few bars of Bill Evans or Oscar Peterson and say, that's Oscar, right?
Yeah. That's not Oscar.
Da, 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 da.
Oscar Peterson with a very strong bluesy strain and enormous swing in his playing.
Right, right.
Bill Evans, by contrast, swings just as much, but by dancing over the rhythm in a very different way.
Their touch is different in their harmonic conception is different to my ears, too.
And all these, you know, as you absorb these different influences, you want it to come out you. You're not doing one artist or another, but we tend to absorb these influences to the point where they're no longer recognizable in what we ourselves play, yeah?
Yeah. The best I can say is I assimilate it within who I am, and I should probably, in parentheses, within the limits of who I am as a person, you know. So I can listen to Oscar Peterson, but I am not Oscar Peterson or Keith Jarrett or Chick Corea. And why I might try to reach in their direction, it is always, I'm always by force of nature myself.
There wouldn't be much point in being anyone else, would there?
Well, one of the players, a pianist who is not well known, Eddie Russ, once took me aside when I was listening to him, and I was a mentor when I was a very young man, and I really admired him. And I was sort of shamefaced talking with him after, Rich, I got to tell you a story. He said, I was working a club as the house pianist, and Oscar Peterson came in for a special weekend. I couldn't even go inside. I was hanging outside. I was around both nights. Finally, somebody told him that the house pianist was outside, and Oscar came out to me, and he told me, he said, hey, this is not a competition, you know. Oscar Peterson plays like Oscar Peterson. Eddie Russ plays like Eddie Russ. Eddie Russ can say things that Oscar Peterson can't. And then Eddie went on and said, Rich Crandall can say things that neither Oscar Peterson or Eddie Russ can say. It's we are all individual. It's sort of the essence of the art form.
Rich Crandall is playing a sold-out show tomorrow evening in Hawaii Public Radio's Atherton Studio. And that's it for this week. Coming up next week, the world's most celebrated imposter looks at ways to break through cybersecurity firewalls. If you have questions or comments, you can call us at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can listen back to our podcast online or via the HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. Lillian Son, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn are our production team. Emily Cardinelli is our intern. And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation.